Welcome back, everyone, to the Drink and Learn podcast. I am drinks historian Elizabeth Pierce.
And I'm bartender Abigail Gallo.
And today we are very excited to bring you the land of agave. It's like an alien. Well, I guess actually agave, because kind of does look like an
it
alien.
It is alien and it has a mysterious origin. So yes, this is like a 1950s episode of The Twilight Zone. We're entering the agave zone.
And the agave zone is mostly in Mexico, although it can grow in southern parts of the United States.
It's mostly
like
used
in Texas and Arizona.
I've seen it in Florida being used as landscaping.
Well, actually, there is a giant agave that is growing in somebody's front yard around the corner from me.
Yes.
And it is always decorated for Christmas with tiny little jingle bells attached to the end of these enormous agave leaves. And it's really funny.
Is that the one that also for Halloween they put tiny skulls on the end? And
yes,
then at Christmas they put little Santa hats on the skulls.
There's a Santa hat, yeah.
I love it.
Yes, you know, it's across from Marquis
yes,
Park.
Yes, I know it very well.
So for those of you that don't know what we're talking about, agave is a plant, and there's lots of different kinds. It's like over 100 different kinds of agave, and there's one in particular that we'll talk about today that's used to make tequila, the blue agave. But you should Google agave plants, and then you'll understand. Or maybe I'll even do something radical, like post it in the Drink and Learn Revelers page, a picture of an agave. Mm-hmm. And then you'll understand why we say that it could look like an alien.
Mm-hmm. It can look like an alien.
Like an octopus alien, yeah. Sort of.
Or a giant aloe plant, which sometimes people think it's related to, but it's not. It's actually a lily. It's in the lily family.
The agave? Or
the agave.
And the aloe plant is in the aloe family?
You know? I don't know what family it's in. Yeah, the healing family. They're both healing in their own ways, though.
Yes, one spiritual and one topically. Mm-hmm. Okay, so a little orientation. I said that we're in the land of agave, or as Abigail says, agave zone, because we will the spirit that most people know that's agave is tequila. But there's more than one. And then there's other spirits that are like agave adjacent. And so we're going to cover all of them quickly, briefly. But we should start with tequila.
Yes.
So I did not know that tequila is the name of a town.
It is.
In Mexico.
It is indeed.
In the state of Jalisco. Mm-hmm. And that, but tequila doesn't have to be made in tequila. Thank goodness. Because that would severely limit production. Tequila is a small place. I guess unless tequila like just decided to spread out and started acquiring suburbs and then like a giant. I'm trying to continue with my like 1950s movie, like taking over.
Tequila then, like, taking over.
Tequila, the city begins to like absorb all the other cities around
yeah.
it. And then eventually it's the entire state. And then it's the entire country.
Well, I think
it is the country of tequila.
And I think that would have happened, except tequila is a recognized appellation of origin, an AOC. So they're very, very strict about where tequila can originate from, who can call what tequila, how it's made. Very much like the care that goes into champagne or cognac. There is mm-hmm. this care with tequila. And while other spirits are now trying to go the same route and create their own recognized appellation of origin, right now the big one, the main one, is still just tequila.
So, you know, when the abbreviation that is used, so the appellation of origin is a thing that started in France mm-hmm. with cognac and then has moved on to what's in Martinique, the rhum agricole. Mm-hmm. They do that there, but it's appellation origine contrôlée. Forgive my French, but like that's the gist,
yes.
Which is AOC.
AOC.
And now, and I was talking about something about the AOC of something to leave the other day, And he was like, wait a second, because that is a very prominent political, right?
Alexandria Octavia Cortez.
Yeah. Yes. And so now when you say AOC, most people think of her. Whatever side of the line you're on, that is what comes to mind. And Lee's like, oh my God, your brain is always in liquor. I'm like, This was first in France. Also, I think AOC is probably a fan of AOC. The newer AOC is a fan of the older. I mean, because she was a bartender,
yes,
right?
Yes, so I believe she would.
She appreciates them.
Yes.
There's some sort of political thing. There's like a meme thing that needs to a meme thing. What am I, like my mother? a meme thing that should happen where
AOC.
She like...
AOC supports AOC. Oh my gosh. Yeah, we need to make this happen. Yeah.
But in Mexico, it's not called AOC because they're not French.
No.
And it's like denomination. No, but it's that's my like French Spanish. That's wrong. I know the term because I was curious about it. Determinazione, that's Italian. Determinazione di origine. It's determination of origin, which I think is but it might be DDC because of is day. Determinazione di origine.
You're mixing your French, like your Italian. Origin. You're such a woman of the world. I can't get over it.
Dear Mexico, I'm really sorry. I do speak Spanish, but clearly not right now. Anyway, yeah, so they had that. And tequila, okay, so tequila can come from the entire state of Jalisco, which is located on the Pacific, plus four other states. So tequila cannot be made just any old place. Mm-mm. And it has to, originally, I thought this was interesting because we're going to talk about a product called mezcal, which some of you may have heard of. But originally, tequila was called Vino Mezcal, uh-huh. because mezcal is a name for the agave plant. And way, way back, pre-colonial times, there was a fermented beverage made from agave. But we have the Spaniards to thank, and really, there's very little we can thank them for, uh-huh. because they were real assholes, those conquistadores, with like slavery and disease and stuff, but they also brought stills. So yay, alembics. And, that's how distillation gets introduced into Mexico.
Well,
and that is how.
Maybe not.
What?
Well, maybe not.
What do you mean? Maybe not.
I mean, have you ever seen a still in Oaxaca that they used to make?
No.
Because it's a Chinese style still.
Oh, so is this a controversy?
This is a little bit of a controversy. A lot of people say give the Spanish credit for introducing distillation, but there's a lot of other people who said, nah, man, those Polynesians on their boats brought it way, 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 way before the Spanish.
I know, it seems heavy on their little boat.
No, they're very small and light, those little Chinese-style stills. They're very different. Well, they're not like the big, certainly the Spanish kicked it into high gear because with the giant alembic stills, they were able to produce much more mass quantities. And we're talking very remote indigenous communities of southern Mexico that never were even touched by the Spanish. So so their type of stills are definitely different than what you would find.
You're talking about in Oaxaca.
In Oaxaca,
these stills are different than the ones that are in Jalisco. Mm-hmm.
In southern Oaxaca and even Guatemala, yeah.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. We can actually, one thing we can thank the Spaniards for sure, even if it's not the stills, is that they wrote all kinds of shit down.
Yes, they did.
Because they were definitely about governing and taxing whenever possible. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we know that when what we now call tequila really begins to be produced because they are documenting its production and potential taxation, mm-hmm. just like they did with rum mm-hmm. in New Orleans.
Yep, Yes, indeed.
Man, the Catholic Church likes to write everything down. So you were telling me you went to, you've toured two different distilleries, one in Guadalajara, mm-hmm. which is a town, which is a city, and in the state of Jalisco, mm-hmm. just for giving everybody a little geography.
And I was in the...
But you were also in Oaxaca, right?
I was in Oaxaca as well, yes.
But is Oaxaca... Is tequila come from there, or that's mezcal?
That's mezcal, comes from Oaxaca.
Okay. All right. Well, then why don't you, this is like moving through time music, but not space music, because this is no longer an alien experience.
No.
It's just Abigail's journey to Mexico, except it should be like Mexican music. So mariachi, perhaps I will put a little mariachi.
Mariachi. The mariachi bands are very famous in Guadalajara. In fact, it's what that region is known for outside of tequila, the mariachi band.
Then why don't you tell us about what you learned when you went to Mexico
sure.
and about how tequila is made
sure.
and mezcal too?
Well, tequila does come from indeed one of five states in the area surrounding Jalisco. There is one exception, a small area, the state of Tampalupas. That is the home of Chinaco tequila, and that lies kind of far away on the eastern coast of the country. But it had been established with plantations of agave as early as the 1960s. So in mm-hmm. 1974, when they first designated the tequila region, they kind of left out I've had a little bit to drink of this beautiful agave. Tamalupas.
Right.
Oh my God, why can't I say the name of this region? I do not speak Spanish, unfortunately. Despite having grown up in a Dominican neighborhood, my accent is kind of Dominican, and these Mexican words leave me flustered. The state was left off when the original AOC was created in 1974, and it wasn't until 1977 that they brought this group in.
Tamaulipas.
Okay, maybe I'm close. All right.
I looked it up. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway.
So the most common, the most like found in the United States, Chinaco is the brand. And if you ever get a chance to taste Chinaco versus any other kind of tequila, do, because you will notice a difference due to the difference in elevation and location of their agave. So these agave plants are now pretty much farmed, and the rules of the AOC include using only one species, the Blue Weber agave. So if you ever...
Weber was a botanist who is definitely not Mexican.
No.
And he's the one who classified it. So that's why this plant that is definitively key in the, like, one of Mexico's most important exports has a name like Weber, mm-hmm. like the grill. The Weber agave.
If we show you some pictures on our Revelers page, we'll show you beautiful fields of Blue Weber, and you'll notice they do take on kind of like a blue hue in the light, especially against the kind of red soil clay that they grow out of, that's like really rich in iron. So these agaves grow to be quite big, with their spines all out. They're bigger than an adult human. And but that's not the part that they used to distill. They cut in the field by hand all these spikes off the plant, and you're left with the heart of the plant, which is called the piña, because it looks like a big pineapple that you have.
And it really does.
Yeah, it really does. But it's, again, not in the pineapple family. It's in the lily family. I'll be reminding people of that the whole time, because there's so many things. Like, 'cause then the next step that they do with tequila is they traditionally roast it for 3 days in stone clay ovens. When they've done that, the agave piña takes on the smell, appearance, taste, a look of pumpkin or squash that's been roasted. But again, not in the squash family, in the lily family.
Although squash is native to west to the Americas.
To the Americas, yes.
As agave is.
Yes.
And actually probably not lilies. I think lilies are from the other side. Mm. I don't actually know that, but I feel like it because they were important in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Tangent.
Now you're making me doubt, like, if they're in the lily family okay. or not. You're freaking me out.
No, because they're not. Well, and maybe they're all related. Okay, now I'm gonna go look that up later, but not right
okay.
now. So there's some really cool pictures of people, the jimadores, mm-hmm. which is the guys who go out and harvest these agave, and they are using tools from. Like the same tools that somebody figured out a long time ago. This is what is best to use to harvest this plant, and they're still using similar shaped ones. And they have some really cool pictures of the guys carrying the piñas on their head because they're so big. Like as they're walking out of the field,
mm-hmm. It's intense, very labor intensive, amazing work. And for anyone who doesn't know this already, you should never buy tequila that is cheap, because normally it is what they call mixto tequila, which means it is this distillate mixed with caramel coloring, mixed with grain alcohol, mixed with all sort of kind of impurities. You can call many things tequila, but in order for it to be the true AOC tequila, it needs to say 100% Blue Weber agave on the bottle, somewhere on the bottle. And it also on the bottle somewhere needs to have a little label that says NOM, N-O-M, and then a number. And that's how they keep track of what distillery that tequila is coming out of, so it can be regulated. Mm-hmm. So if you do not see 100% Blue Weber agave on the bottle of tequila, if you do not see a NOM number, then please do not drink it. It is not very good. It might be cheaper, but you'll notice a big price jump as soon as you try to find a bottle that looks like this. But it is well worth it, not only for the taste and your own health, but also for the moral implications of how this incredible labor-intensive work is being done and how well the jimadores are being paid. So,
it also, I think, the fact most people don't know, even today, most of the tequila that is imported in the United States is mixto. Mm-hmm. So everybody think about that. And whatever you think about tequila, recognize that what you think you've had has not really been tequila, that you've had some diluted substandard product, and that even that your bad memories that are associated with it, with its taste, with this thing that just needed to be shot and like chased with your lime and salt and not even savored or enjoyed, was probably something that doesn't even taste like what it should. Wait, we're getting ahead of ourselves, because what I think is really cool is after they bake the piñas.
Yes.
How does a piña pumpkin get turned into tequila?
Well, the next step is after they harvest it, after they roast it, and sometimes they use like a giant pressure cooker, like your larger houses are going to use like a what they call an autoclave, and it's basically like a giant instant pot that they use to cook it down. The next step is that they grind that roasted piña up, and they can do that. Traditionally, they did it with a tajone, which is a giant round stone that they hook onto a pole, and it rolls around in a circle being pulled by a mule, a horse, people, or a tractor. And it goes around, and they put the chunks of agave in this like well, like a little moat, and they squeeze all the roasted agave juices out, and the juices drain into a pot where they collect it. And then that's what they take to go start the fermentation process.
And if you've ever seen agave syrup, like in the grocery store, you know, because that's a thing people like to buy now. Mm-hmm. Agave syrup would be that juice that's just cooked down a little bit so that it thickens. Mm-hmm. So if you want to just taste agave, probably the easiest way to like taste agave in its most natural state is to have a spoonful of agave syrup. Mm-hmm. Like that'd be the easiest way to do that these days, especially if you live not in Mexico.
Yeah. Of course, again, it's a big production. They can't have a lot of tractors and mules pulling big round stones from the prehistoric age. So there is a roller mill shredding that washes the that is more efficient in getting the fibers off. So there's like different sorts of grinders that different people use. Then it's very much like a very familiar distilling process. They go into giant fermentation tanks. The types of yeasts are kind of added to add flavor, or else they just use the natural yeast in the air. A lot of them have open wooden fermentation tanks that creates a very different flavor than like a stainless steel tank. And then it goes into, you know, pretty traditional stainless pot stills. Occasionally, there are column stills used as well. There are copper pot stills used. There's, you know, depending on which house, they all use their own kind of different still to bring that special flavor and taste.
And if this is anybody's first episode, Abigail and I talk about stills in the Old World Whiskey episode when we talk about Scotch and Irish whiskey. So you can go back and listen to that and learn about stills.
But here we're talking tequila. Tequila is usually distilled only once or twice, occasionally three times. But you don't want to – the flavor is much more delicate.
Like how often is vodka distilled?
Vodka, well, I mean, some vodkas are distilled like 45 times, you know, it's right, the purest vodka, but most vodkas are distilled at least six times.
Okay, so that gives everybody a sense to compare, that it's going through that process twice or even more than twice mm-hmm. as much.
That distillation that comes out can be bottled and sold as Blanco tequila. Some Blanco tequilas are rested in or on oak up to 60 days as well. Some are mellowed with some of that wood spirit, but for the most part, most of them are just, you know, pure Blanco spirit, very clean and bright. You'll get that hints of pumpkin. You'll also get like this very green notes to it. They believe that a lot of tequilas have, just like Scotch, have like a highland and lowland, a terroir, depending on where they harvested the agave. So there's a lot of different flavors just within this one category using one just – and this is important to remember for later. This is one category using one main style of production and using only one species of the agave plant.
And if you – are interested in trying a tequila that has a little age on it, you can get the Reposado, which is in oak for a few months.
Up to 1 year.
Or the Añejo.
After 1 year.
Añejo is a year.
Reposado means rested, so it's just rested in oak barrels for less than a year. Because añejo means year. As soon as it hits a year in a barrel, it is classified as an añejo.
And it's interesting, you know, we're a big fan of doing the taste test, is to get the same brand and try their silver, their reposado, and their añejo.
Yeah.
So that you're seeing what the barrel can do to a tequila.
The whole idea of using barrels in tequila is a purely 20th century phenomenon involving the Americans who drink it. And it was created to appeal to the American scotch and whiskey drinker that the tequila have some color on it. So, you know, I always say when you were in college and you did awful, awful shots of some gold looking tequila and you had to like shoot it while you were like sucking a lime and licking salt off your girlfriend's hand or whatever.
Or whatever other body part.
Gross, weird tradition that y'all have. If you taste just some good Blanco clean tequila or even a good Reposado, you taste
100% agave.
100% agave.
Yeah, agave. Yeah.
You can taste the salinity and the saltiness of it. You could taste the green, verde, limeness of it and the tartness of it. Like sucking a lime and licking salt while you down a shot of bad tequila was just trying to mimic the flavor of what you get from shooting or sipping just a really nice mm-hmm. tequila. So when people still yeah. order like really nice tequilas, but they say they want what we in the bar industry call training wheels, which is salt and lime to go with it, I said, you're ruining the whole point of ordering a good tequila. You don't need salt and lime. Those flavors are already there, and it's really delicious.
Yeah. I thought something I learned in getting ready for this episode is that while we think of tequila as being this definitive Mexican product that has been embraced by the country, since the Spanish started writing down that they are going to tax it in the 1700s, it actually kind of comes and goes in popularity as the country is being colonized, and that it's just like what happens in the Caribbean, where the people in power want to drink the imported spirit, right? So like fine dining meant French wines and French spirits. Mm-hmm. And then, the tequila is like for the common man. But after the Mexican Revolution in the late 19th, early 20th century, tequila emerges, and it's actually really pushed by the new government as this symbol of Mexico and symbol of like a thing for Mexicans to be proud of. And then it begins to be exported coincidentally with Prohibition. So because Mexico is like right there. So while we hear more about rum coming from the Caribbean, there's also a lot of tequila making its way into the United States as a result of Prohibition. And the other cool thing that I learned is that tequila moves from the cantina, which is the province of men, little by little into the home as a result of movies. So in the 1930s, both Mexicans and Americans began to see there's this style of Mexican cinema called cinema ranchero, which is like they're Westerns. Mm-hmm. And there's always like a mariachi, with a bottle of tequila, and it's in a bar. But as you like trace tequila's presence in the movies, little by little, you start to see women drinking it. And then it becomes a thing that it gets classier and classier, and it's offered in the home. And in the home, it's offered with the side of what's called sangrita, mm-hmm. which means, like, it literally means little blood, in the way that sangria in Spanish is called that, because sangre is blood. It's not made with blood. It's made color of blood. It's actually not the exact color of blood, because, ew. It's just, you know what I mean? It's red. And until a little while ago, I've been reading that sangrita is made with tomato juice, but it's not. It is made with orange juice, grenadine, and Cointreau, which sounds way more delicious, but also completely different.
It's also a tequila sunrise.
Yes, and so, like, who got tomato? Who was like, you know what? We can't get grenadine or whatever. Let's just use tomato juice. That's not the same thing. It's not a one-for-one swap, you know? How disgusting. So now I'm, like, super excited to go and because y'all don't know, I was talking with Abigail about this. I'm going to Mexico City in about 2 weeks, and we'll be drinking lots of agave spirit things. And I am really excited to be served some sangrita alongside my tequila. And that's what you have your little, if you want to have I don't think it's meant to be a chaser. I think it's supposed to be just an accompaniment.
Yes. Yes. It's a little pony glass of a little something extra, a lanyap, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you might find there's a lot made with tomato juice still. It's usually like a sweet tomato juice, though, you know, with the orange and everything in it. But
okay. I mean, I know tomatoes are fruit. Nobody needs to write in while we're classifying our botanicals.
Think of it like a little sweet gazpacho shot. That's what it's kind of like.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, that actually goes really well. Yeah, I would love, that's a great idea. I should offer people at Ben Paris, instead of training wheels, when they order a nice tequila to shoot, I should also offer them some sangrita. And let's do it the way that they do it in the homes with the ladies.
Yeah, because I haven't been to Mexico City in almost 10 years. And I was not really a big tequila drinker back then. So now I'll be paying more attention.
Well, I think you will actually not drink a lot of tequila. There is one brand I love. I can't remember the name, but I could see the label. It's got like a horse on it. And traditionally, the people of Guadalajara, at least, prefer their tequila at a lower proof, like at around 70, 72, mm-hmm. which is okay. Lower. You won't find any tequila like that in the United States, because by law, our spirits are mostly distilled to 80 proof. So that's a nice thing to look for in your tequilas when you go down there. The other thing is that not only are you going to see a heck of a lot more mezcal, you're going to see in Mexico City a great deal of Rosia and Sotal. And you're going to see all these other different strains of agave. And you're going to want to try them all. And you're going to forget about tequila for a while.
Well,
because we don't have access to any of that here.
Yeah. So I'm going with Lee, which means I will not forget about tequila, no matter how hard I try. but he is also an agave junkie, and not just agave. So we had to go to Mexico for a wedding last year, and we went to what was supposed to be like the best tequila bar in Cancun. And it was one of those great moments where we walked in and he was looking at like what was visible, and he like looked sad. And I was like, what's the matter? And he's like, I don't know why this is supposed to be the best. He's like, there's not really a very good selection. But then I asked, you know, discúlpame, porfa. Like, we are here to try tequila. We read this was a great tequila bar. And then the guy's like, oh. And so then he reached under the bar, which people sitting in the bar could not see. And then he began to just, like, pull all the stuff out. And that's where we learned about Rosia, which Lee loves and I think is odd. And can you take us through quickly? So you mentioned mezcal too, mm-hmm. which you spoke of as if everybody should know what that is. But quick, down and dirty, mezcal, rosia, and sotol.
Okay. Quick down and dirty. Mezcal usually comes from the region of Oaxaca. Now, I did mention that tequila is made from just one species of agave. There are literally hundreds of different species. So mezcal kind of opens that up a little bit. Mezcal tends to be made from the states in southern Mexico surrounding Oaxaca, but you have so many different microclimates within that area, so you could have a lot of variety and flavor. On top of that, they also use many numerous different classifications of agave. So you have espadine, you have quiche, you have tobala, you have all these different styles. In addition to that, what makes mezcal extremely different is the production. So when they go to roast the agave, rather than roasting them in traditional stone clay ovens or an autoclave, they actually dig a hole in the ground. In the bottom of this, they put volcanic rocks, large boulders, which they surround with debris and wood, which they burn, creating kind of these rocks turn into hot coals. Then they put the piña on top of the hot coals, put some banana leaves or a tarp on top of it, and bury it underground. And it smokes underground for 3 days. Now, then it is distilled once, maybe refined once, but is still a very raw product. I mentioned that their stills look different. The places where this is made are called palenques. The men and women who make them are palenqueros, and they are usually in very, very small towns using open-air fermented wooden tanks. There's all the production is pretty much done basically outside. You're looking at, there's one gentleman I went to see who didn't like animals near his agave. So while other places had a mule or a horse that had the tahone around, this gentleman had a big trough and these giant wooden clubs that look like what a cartoon caveman would use to knock out his mate and drag her back to the cave. And he'd have his workers sit there with these giant clubs and stand on either side of the trough where the roasted agave was, and they would pound them by hand. And I did it. I did it for about 45 seconds, maybe, and I was exhausted. Mm-hmm. And these guys do it all day to pound that juice out of the roasted agave flesh before it's distilled.
You know, there's got to be some kind of excursion that he could sell to frustrated rich Americans who need to take out their anger on something, you know, some kind of like Iron John, you know, like where the men are like, I don't feel masculine enough in my white collar business job. And this CrossFit is not like scratching the itch anymore. And I really need to like prove that I'm like this physically strong guy, and then they could pay hundreds of dollars to spend a day pounding agave.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Wonderful idea.
Dear agave maker man, I had an idea for you.
These little towns where they make this, for the most part, they make their agave and they make their mezcal and they send it to these giant producers where they just kind of mix it and blend it all together and sometimes put a scorpion or a worm in the bottle because this stuff is super smoky. Like the flavor is very different. You still don't get that underlying green and roasted pumpkin, but the flavor is super smoky, like a scotch. And I happened to visit Oaxaca about 4 months later. I was in Scotland, in Islay, with the peatiest, smokiest scotch. And there was definitely a point in my tastings where I kind of forgot where I was. In Oaxaca, I was like, man, I feel like I'm just drinking scotch. And in Scotland, at Ardbeg in particular, I felt like I was just drinking mezcal. So it was a very cool experience to have those two so kind of relatively close within my year, those two travels, because they are kind of produced the same way and, you know, on opposite sides of the planet by completely different people. So it's kind of amazing that they realize, hey, let's smoke this agave and see what different flavor we get. So
I was going to ask you, are there, I know there's not really a lot of scotch cocktails, but are there any scotch or mezcal cocktails that you've swapped the other out for?
Yes, I have done that on numerous occasions. They both make great modifiers. You want to add a little smokiness to a bourbon old fashioned. I'll put like a little spritz of a really smoky peaty scotch. I have a beautiful rum daiquiri on the menu, the First Salute right now, and I wanted to give it a deeper, darker kind of smoke. I added a half ounce of mezcal to it. So
I'm totally going to do that. Did you keep your 2 ounces of regular rum, or was it 1.5 regular?
I usually go down to 1.5 regular.
Okay. Mm. I'm going to make that.
Yeah.
Like maybe tonight.
It's really good.
I'll let you know.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's mezcal.
That's mezcal. And mezcal, just so you know, it's the culture down there, like I said, wasn't really touched by the Spanish. It's still Zapotec was the native people. And the native people who lived there, their big heyday was right before the Aztecs. So the Aztecs were the ones everyone knows because that's who the Spanish conquered. But before the Aztecs came into the power, the most powerful group of people were the Zapotecs, which are based in Oaxaca. In southern Mexico. So that area, because it never really got conquered, is still very Zapotec. A lot of people speak Spanish as their second language, Zapotec being their first. Also, they handle land ownership down there rather than the European Spanish way, which is you buy the land, you own it. They have the more native people's kind of idea that we are just stewards on the land here to take care of it, but the land really doesn't belong to anyone. So in these small towns, what would happen is these palenqueros who make the best mezcal, every year they would be recognized by their peers for making the best mezcal, and they would get access to the best agave in the next year. Agave sometimes taking 5 to 12 years to mature. So what you started to see is every town had one, after generation and generation and generation, had one excellent mezcal maker. And one man, an American man named Ron Cooper, who was a New Yorker who had settled in New Mexico and become an artist and was traveling extensively in Mexico. And he started to get to know these guys and realize that they were getting paid pennies on the gallon for their beautiful, beautiful distillate that was just getting mixed with other really bad distillate. So in the 90s, he had an idea to take these guys and offer them way more money than they were getting from their local big conglomerate and have them bottle special single village mezcal. And he had his friends who were artists design the bottles. And thus you have Del Maguey, the brand that changed everything for mezcal. There's a beautiful book called Finding Mezcal that is written by Ron Cooper. I recommend if anyone wants to look more into this process and what happened to Oaxaca and what happened when Ron Cooper kind of introduced these families to higher wages, but also to the rest of the world and introduced mezcal to the rest of the world. It's very, very interesting. And he's really the guy that started it all. Every bottle of mezcal that you see on the shelf, they have Ron Cooper to thank. For getting the word out to Americans about this amazing, unique, different, and I mean, highly handcrafted product. They do it all by sight, by feel, by taste, by smell. They don't have fancy, you know, like if you've ever been to a big distillery in Scotland or even Kentucky, you see it's all machines running everything and one person pressing a button. Here, it's the whole community comes out to help with the harvest, to help with the roast, the blessing of the roast, to help, you know, smash those palenques, even though, yes, I would really like white men to pay thousands of dollars to these guys to come and get their aggressions out on these piñas in troth. So don't ever balk about how much you have to spend on a bottle of mezcal. It is worth it. These people, this is the most handcrafted spirit on the planet, for sure. I'm very passionate about this. Can you tell?
I know. I just let you go because not everybody, well, actually I'm the only one that can watch you because nobody else can see the video, but like Abigail's eyes got big, and like there were gestures of like, yeah, I really enjoyed watching your passion.
So now, and you know, the danger is, of course, is now these precious plants and these precious ecosystems are being overfarmed and overharvested, and this is happening very quickly in tequila, but also in mezcal. And so people are starting to look at other things that lie outside of the states, that lie outside of the denomination de origin, other recognized agave spirits. So you have Resia. Resia is a little more funky. I'm actually...
It's a lot more fun.
Really? You have to find the specific one, because I tell you, girl, I'm drinking Resia right now. Hold on.
Let me see which one it is. Okay. I don't think I've had that one, but Lee had a couple that he really liked. He loves the funk.
Yeah.
And it definitely... we had one and it was like Cheetos funky.
Yes. Like a lot of them funky. Will smell like Cheetos cheese. Yeah.
Yeah. It smells like cheese and it doesn't taste like cheese.
No.
But
no.
It definitely has that nose.
Yeah.
So what's Resia made from?
Agave. Same thing.
So what I think that was very interesting about Sotol, which again, I didn't know about until we went to Cancun, is it's not made from agave. Since you were talking about the, you know, how long it takes for agave to grow, the Sotol, so it's a plant, but it's also the name of the distill of the spirit, is agave adjacent.
Mm-hmm.
It is it is not that plant. And there's a whole lot of them because nobody has been harvesting them.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently a lot of American distillers who are interested in entering this market but can't because they can't make tequila legally and really can't make mezcal. And it's hard to get into anything that's in the agave spirits market because first you need agave.
Mm-hmm.
But I was reading that the Sotol is essentially, what are those plants that grow and grow and people are, it's like a weed, but it's not a weed because it's enormous. So it's invasive. That's the word.
Mm-hmm.
It puts out little seedlings that sprout and animals don't like it. So it's not getting eaten.
Mm-hmm.
And ranchers don't like it because it's in the way. And it actually, it should be the next big thing, but in a good way, because it could kind of scratch that itch for a spirit that evokes these other agave spirits, but is being made from something that right now is growing in abundance. And I can't remember what Sotol tasted like, because I only had it that one time and we didn't bring any home.
I think it's rather clean and bright, the Sotol that I found, as opposed to the Resia, which like smells like cheese and tastes like chocolate covered cherries. Sotol is green and vegetal and bright, but has a little bit of that funk, but not so much. You know, a lot of this mm-hmm. is just the same agave. Some of them, they're called Resia and they're made with Blue Weber. They're just made outside of tequila. Like you could find so many different variations. That's why it's really important to taste, because all Resias aren't going to taste the same. All mezcals certainly don't taste the same. Tequila is the only thing that I think, I mean, you really, it's kind of like tasting vodka. So if you put them side by side, yes, you could tell a difference. But if you're going to mix them in a margarita, you really can't. And that's kind of how I feel about tequila, with the exception of maybe Chinaco, because I really do like the distinct different flavor that it has. Everything else is just, you know, some of these things are just made the same way, but they're just made outside of that denomination of origin, and they don't have access or the money to make it that way. So they make it their own way. They bury it in the ground. Resia is buried like mezcal is, but it's made near tequila. And it tastes so supremely different. It just goes mm-hmm. to show you how terroir makes a big difference, whether it's where it's grown or where it's buried or even where it's aged. You know, we all know that all of that matters and affects the taste of the spirits. There's a Bacanora as well. Mm-hmm. That's another one. Again, the difference is probably is where it's made and what they're using.
So something that Lee's been really into agave spirits recently and also has been using your recipe with his own tweaks to make margaritas.
Oh.
Like almost every night.
What?
And now he's like made his, he's got his perfect margarita figured out, except it now has to change. So per your observation that, you know, not all tequilas are exactly the same.
No.
He had, and of course, like not all limes are the same either.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, everybody, guess what? When you make a drink with something that like grows and that is harvested, it's going to have different levels of sweetness and acid. And so now he's started learning to like see how limey the lime is, and you know, adjust accordingly. But depending on the tequila he uses, he is upping and downing the amount of lime or the amount of, well, now he's really into dry curacao, so he's been using that, or Cointreau, nice. Or you know, or whatever. But I think that is an important takeaway for a lot of the revelers have been, you know, when they post about things that they've been inspired to make, that if you like taste it before, if you go to a bar and you watch a bartender, even if they're making a drink that they've made 100 times before, a lot of times they'll do that straw test, and it's because they're just checking it out before they send it off to you. And you can do that too. In your home, you can do your own straw test before you serve yourself, you know, and recognize that once you start changing spirits, to not rely on the exact spec that you've been using, even if it's, you know, a recipe that you've already liked, because going from one tequila to another is something Lee's really, and like, oh, you know, I don't have to use as much lime with this one or mm-hmm. whatever.
Exactly. Exactly. You should always make adjustments to your own taste. Oh, you'll really like this, Elizabeth. You know the story of Bacanora, which is kind of like in between tequila and mezcal, is, you'll appreciate this, it was banned, prohibition style, in the early 1900s because the governor of Sonora, where it's made, was at the time very religious and believed drinking and producing alcohol was immoral. The ban wasn't lifted until 1992.
What?
Yep.
That was a really loud what?
You could be hung. You could be hanged for making it because of this Gilead of a leader.
Well, I don't think he was around the whole time.
No, he wasn't. But so they didn't do anything to take it off.
Yeah. You know what, though? You know what I bet, though? Okay, this is what we all learned from watching Boardwalk Empire. Is that... yes, you could be hanged. Okay, so that's definitely worse than regular prohibition when you could just get arrested or have to pay a fine. But somebody in there figured out how to make money, either bringing it in from somewhere else or making it in secret and selling it, and then became reluctant to lift that ban, a la the state of Mississippi, which did not permit distilled spirits in the state until 1966, even though you could totally get hard liquor in Mississippi before 1966. Now, I don't know this, right? So I have not been there to interview the people of this region and ask, but this is just my suspicions of what everything I've learned about any prohibition is that, what is it in Jurassic Park? Life finds a way.
Yes. Yes, yeah. It does.
So, yeah. But that doesn't mean it's okay. It's definitely not okay to ban it and then hang people. That's pretty awful. Well, now I want to try some of that too. I have a big list. We have 6 days and, you know, 160 drinks to try.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you're going to be in one of the, well, definitely the largest city in Mexico, one of the largest cities in the world. It's such a beautiful city. Oh, y'all, if you've never been to Mexico City, it is just, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
It is. I love all the public art that's just everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the first time I went there was right after Hurricane Katrina. And I responded so viscerally to how like alive it was and just vibrant and full of people. Mm-hmm. And then I went back a few years later and had an equally wonderful time. And I'm very excited to go back and eat and drink all the things, see all the things.
There's lovely people there.
Do you have a recipe?
We have a joke. We totally have a joke. So we had a gentleman come into the bar who was from a very sophisticated drinking city. I shan't say the name of this city, but it rhymes with Fran Francisco. And he considered himself a very astute drinker because he comes from such a fancy drinking city.
Yeah.
And when he noticed at my bar that I had, you know, ingredients to make lots of drinks and seemed to have interest in cocktails, he asked me if I could possibly make a paloma, but with mezcal. Bum, bum, bum. And I was like, yes, I can. So a paloma, for those who don't know, is a traditional...
It's a bird. It's a bird.
It's a dove. It means dove. Yes. And this has become the hot new Mexican cocktail. Like, if you're tired of drinking margaritas, have a paloma. And traditionally,
they're not the same thing. I mean, they're... No. Okay, whatever. Yeah.
No, it's... Well, traditionally, a paloma is basically just... tequila and grapefruit soda. So think of like Fanta.
But it's the jaritos, right? Or jaritos?
Yes.
Jaritos. Like there's no B, right? It's the jaritos. No.
Jaritos. It's like a Mexican grapefruit soda. Yeah.
Grapefruit
soda. And, you know, we didn't really have access to good grapefruit soda in the bars. So we started using fresh grapefruit juice, a little bit of agave, a splash of lime, and then top it with soda. So that's our like kind of fancy mixology paloma, which is quite lovely. But now there are people, just like there are people who think that the gimlet has to be made with Rose's lime juice, and they go out of their way to duplicate Rose's lime juice. We are now duplicating like really funky, good grapefruit soda to mix with palomas. And Jim Meehan has come out with, has helped with.
Tell who Jim Meehan is, because not everybody knows that.
Jim Meehan is the first man to win a James Beard Award for Best Bar Program for PDT, in which stands for Please Don't Tell, in New York City. And he is working with a tonic company, East Imperial Tonic and Sodas. And they are now, not only did they come out with a really nice grapefruit tonic, they're coming out with a grapefruit soda. So we now at the bar... are making real palomas with grapefruit soda instead of mixing grapefruit juice with soda water. Puh, puh.
When you could just like go down to the bodega and like buy the jaritos, you know, 8 for $2 or something.
It's very complicated. But long story short, if you want to try something a little different, and a lot of people are going to bars and ordering, you know, a mezcal margarita or a mezcal paloma. Mezcal is so much more powerful and stronger than tequila. I would always recommend doing a split base. Try 50-50. You know, make it with half tequila, half mezcal. Or, you know, introduce some sotal or resia or bacanora or something different into it because there are lots of flavors to experiment to. So I'd say, yeah, get that bodega grapefruit soda, try it with some tequila, try it with some grapefruit, fresh squeezed grapefruit peel will do a lot to kind of amplify that flavor. Grapefruit and orange are two citrus that tend to pair better with mezcal. And I think it's because of that roasted pumpkin and smoky flavor goes really good. Think of like a roasted orange or a roasted grapefruit and how delicious that is. So, so yeah, definitely play with those flavors and don't be afraid of sotol or mezcal or tequila. Just make sure that they do say made in Mexico and 100% agave. I know. We mentioned there are other people in Texas and California that are experimenting with agave spirits that are made here in America. But I'd like to continue to support the hardworking craftsmen and women of Mexico as they produce some of the most glorious, beautiful spirits on the planet, all from this amazing plant using ancient techniques that haven't changed.
From the alien plant. So when I get back, I will definitely give a full report. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who are not on the Facebook Revelers page, our fans, I encourage you to go there and scroll. You may have to scroll back a little bit. If you listen to the gin episode and you heard Abigail and I muse on the decorative possibilities of a bathtub as a vessel for chilling drinks at a party. I don't know if you saw that a woman posted that she went to a party and a clawfoot bathtub was in the middle of the living room and it was full of champagne bottles.
It's like a chilling dream come true.
And I was like, was the host inspired by us? And she's like, no, the party was in 2017, which clearly meant that we are on the pulse of what's hot in entertainment.
Clearly.
But what I guess I need to follow up and ask her, like, did this person schlep that clawfoot tub in just for the party or does
I would.
It just live there? Those are heavy.
I know, but you get a friend to help you and you're done. You could get smaller ones too. Those little mini half-size ones are great.
Actually, my great-grandmother's house had a half-size one and I used to love to bathe in it because I could like scooch down and be like up to my chin and then rest my feet on the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was great.
My parents had one too.
And when you're little... Like when you're a little kid, then it's just like the bathtub is for you. It's like your size bathtub. But even when you're a grown up and your entire body doesn't fit in comfortably, it doesn't matter. You just like hang your feet out and it's okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's all good. You know, we love dangling our feet into a pool. Why not dangle your body and dangle your feet outside?
Right. It's the opposite. So this concludes another roundup of spirit and
I hope you've enjoyed agave spirits as much as we have. Like, don't be afraid of them. I know everyone had that horrible experience. Please don't give them another chance. They're absolutely delicious. Be conscious about who you're buying from. Know that you do have to spend some money, but you don't have to spend a lot.
Yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, it's for true. So feel free, if you have any questions, to post them either on the Facebook Revelers fan page on Facebook. I said that already. The Facebook Revelers fan page. You can also send it in an email to cheers@drinkandlearn. You can message Drink and Learn. If you want to reach out to Abigail, you can do so on her social media, which is
Abigail Gullo, G-U-L-L-O, on Instagram, just my name, and on Twitter at NYC Baby.
So one of the things that I learned at the podcast conference was that ask a very simple thing that it's never occurred to me to ask. As you know, Abigail and I have been asking you to rate and review us. Mm-hmm. But we also would really like you to subscribe. So some of you may be listening, but you haven't actually subscribed. Please subscribe right now. Right now. Go do it.
Just do it. It's easy. I think you like press a button. It's done.
Yeah, you press subscribe. And also,
doesn't cost anything.
If you are a fan of the podcast, please this week go tell somebody that you think would enjoy it. You can share one episode with that person that you think is like the total old-fashioned fan or somebody who's really into scotch or, you know, or whatever. You can share a specific episode. Or you can just do as sometimes the young people on my tour do with the older people, which is where they just snatch the phone out of their hand and then they look up the Drink and Learn podcast and then they explain what a podcast is and they say, this is the app that you use, and then they press subscribe and they're like, you're all set. So feel free to do that. And I don't mean to sound ageist, but these are just the demographics that I've observed. So if you know somebody who you think would enjoy this, but they have no idea what a podcast is, then do them the favor and explain.
Yeah.
Anyway, until next time, cheers, y'all.
Cheers, y'all.